I've been doing with my supervisor there, Pedro Ferreira, and most of it is also in collaboration with a postdoc at Oxford, Tessa Baker. And I'm going to be talking about how we can test gravity using cosmological probes, and how we can understand the degeneracies that come into play when we try to do this. So I'll give a quick introduction as to why we care about alternative theories of gravity that are motivated by cosmology. And then I'll talk about two sort of analytic-based approaches to understanding degeneracies that sort of plague this type of observation. The first one I'll spend most of the talk on, and then I'll give a quick sort of current work interlude about the specific ease of G, and then at the end I'll conclude. So first, to just motivate what we're talking about a bit, so why do we care about cosmologically motivated theories of gravity? Probably everyone in this room knows why we care about this, but I guess I'll just give a quick background. So in 1998-1999, we had these supernova-based observations by the Riese and Perlmutter groups that showed us that omega lambda was definitively or relatively definitively non-zero. And this is telling us that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. And this is the plot from the Riese paper showing that. And so what this means is that we have this accelerating expansion in the universe, and we had to figure out some way to explain it. So there's a few different options. We can attribute this to a dynamical dark energy, a physical component, which has exotic behavior. And there are many models that try and do that. We can also consider the possibility that gravity might be not quite what we think it is on cosmological scales. And to be clear, just in this talk, I'm sure there are people in the room who might work on quantum gravity motivated alternatives to GR. I'm going to be talking pretty much exclusively about cosmologically motivated alternative theories of gravity today, so just to make that distinction. And of course, the sort of the final way that, not the final way, but another way, a very common way to resolve this issue is to use the standard cosmological model tool of the lambda in lambda CDM. So this is a cosmological constant, and in combination with GR, this seems to fit the data incredibly well. So this is the Planck 2015 temperature CMB power spectrum, and the red curve is the theory curve using GR and lambda CDM, and obviously that looks great. So why do we care about considering anything else? So there's a couple of different reasons we can motivate still looking at alternative theories of gravity. One of which is that all of our constraints on omega lambda are gravitationally based. So just to be a little bit careful, we want to sort of do a cross-check and figure out for sure if GR is what we actually think we have on cosmological scales. And then there's things like theoretically motivated issues with lambda CDM, the fine-tuning problem. If we really have a constant vacuum energy, then our predictions from QFT for the energy density are vastly different by orders of magnitude than what we measure. So these are all reasons that we might want to consider a modified theory of gravity on cosmological scales. So what I'm going to be talking about today is how we test and constrain that. And I'm going to be talking about this in relation to a few different cosmological observations. So we'll just give a quick background on what those are, just to sort of do an overview. So the first one that I'm going to be talking about mostly is weak gravitational lensing. And so gravitational lensing, as we all know, is the effect where we have a source of light far away, usually a galaxy in this case. And the light that is coming from that source comes towards us, the observer, on or near Earth. And in between those two places, we have other massive bodies. So we either have galaxies and galaxy halos, or we have just dark matter filaments and the cosmic like structure. And either way, we can consider the way that the light from the distant source bends and is lensed as it comes towards us, the observer. And the way that this happens is dependent on the nature of gravity on cosmological scales. So this is how we can get at gravity using lensing. Specifically, weak gravitational lensing is the case where this effect is small enough that from a single source, we can't discern the effect. So we have to combine many sources and add their effect statistically to get a signal. So that's the observable that I'm going to be spending most of the time talking about. There's another couple that I'll talk about in relation to using weak gravitational lensing. And the first one, I'll just give a quick explanation, redshift-based distortions. So redshift-based distortions are the effect by which, so we have the galaxy galaxies that we measure, their position, we can measure their correlations between them. And when we do this, we're measuring in retro space. So the galaxies will have a velocity sort of due to the Hubble flow. They'll also have a velocity, a peculiar velocity, due to the gravitational effects from infalling towards overdensities of mass. And this gravitational effect of these peculiar velocities will cause distortions to what would otherwise be a homogeneous an isotropic correlation function in two dimensions. So this is from a paper from the 2D FGRS galaxy survey, and you can see that this 2D correlation function, it's not isotropic, it's squeezed, and that's a result of peculiar velocities. So this is like a gravitational effect, and hence we can get at the nature of gravity using it. Finally, baryonic acoustic oscillations, I'll talk about briefly. So this is a result of the fact that in the early universe, baryons and photons formed a plasma, and baryons, of course, were affected by gravity. So if we have an overdensity of dark matter, baryons want to fall towards the overdensity. However, they're in a plasma with photons, which have radiation pressure. So we have this oscillation occurring. At some point, of course, we have recombination. Photons free stream away, and we have this excess of baryons at a characteristic distance away from an overdensity of dark matter. Of course, this is happening at many different points in the universe. So what we actually have is a statistical overdensity at sort of a standard ruler distance of sort of on the order of 150 megaparsec. And we can measure that in our correlation function. So this is a measurement from SDSS of that. And because this is a gravitational effect, again, where the baryons collapsing towards dark matter overdensities is informed by gravity, we can get at the nature of gravity and the nature of the expansion history. So these are the probes I'm going to be talking about. But specifically, I'm not just going to be talking about the probes. I'm also going to be talking about how we can understand how cosmological parameters may be degenerate when we're trying to test gravity with these probes. So obviously, we know a degeneracy is when more than one physical effect has the same observational effect. So that sounds problematic, and it is. And we want to understand how we can combine observations to get rid of this problem. And there's a few different ways we can do this. And today I'm going to be talking about using sort of quasi-analytic approaches to do this. So one way that we could go would be to sort of create mock data and then sample the parameter space and see what kind of constraints we would expect to get. And that is like absolutely an extremely valuable tool, and we should do that. But at this stage, for gravitational constraints, we're looking at being far enough out from sort of next generation surveys that there is something to be gained and to be learned from looking at sort of the expressions for what we expect our observables to be in an analytic way, and sort of laying out these are how the physical effects are going to come in, and this is what we expect to see in terms of degeneracies. So I'm going to talk about two ways to do that today. And the first one is something that we're calling a linear response approach. So there's two references here. One of them is mostly focusing on weak lensing, and the other one is mostly focusing on redshift space distortions. And basically what I mean by a linear response approach is a case where we're considering only small deviations from GR and lambda CDM, because observations tell us that this is what we have. And by doing this, it allows us to construct a novel expression for the power spectrum of the weak lensing observable convergence. So I'll go through that. First, we need to worry about how we're going to parameterize deviations from general relativity. So I'm not going to speak today about particular theories of gravity. And the reason that we've chosen not to focus on a single theory of gravity or on multiple single theories of gravity is to kind of take an observationally minded approach. So when you're analyzing data from a weak lensing survey or whatever survey, most often it's not practical to redo this analysis for each different theory of gravity and each different set of parameters. So what's done is to use this parameterization, which I'll describe now, which is able to encapsulate the vast majority of cosmologically viable theories of gravity that are motivated by cosmology. So what we're going to be using is something called the quasi-static approximation. And this is an approximation that's valid in the regime where we have significantly some horizon scales, which we expect to be valid for sort of near future and next generation galaxy and lensing surveys. And basically this means that we drop our time derivatives in our gravitational equations of motion. And because we do this, we are able to simplify the equations such that for the vast majority of cosmologically motivated theories of gravity, we can parameterize the difference between this theory and general relativity in a very simple form. So that's the part that we care about really here.
Do you need to have quasi-static to do linear response?
Let me think about that. I would say in principle.
Or could you also have
like an EFT or something
for the
for like PPF or
the horizon?
Yeah. I think that in principle you could do it without doing the quasi-static approximation. We haven't done that. It would be more complicated, but it was probably worth looking into. Because
Tess has been thinking about stuff like that.
Yeah, I think that maybe Phil and Tessa have a paper on, this is Phil Bull and Tessa Baker, have a recent paper or a paper coming out soon on large scale sort of near horizon constraints from future surveys.
And that's still linear response.
I'm not sure that it's linear response, but on horizon scales, we think that we should still be near GR and lambda CDM. So I don't see why you couldn't do it. I'd have to think about technically how you would approach it, because it would be a bit different than the way we approach it here. But I think you could do it, if that makes sense. So just to give a couple of examples of theories for which this parameterization is going to be valid, and ones which you might want to be a bit careful. This is not exhaustive, but just to give an idea.
What do you mean when you say it's valid for example, if I were to suggest that one of those theories were secretly unstable or something, would it really expect such a regime to exist?
Okay.
What are you saying?
So what I'm saying is that if you take the theories that I've listed as valid, if you write down the equations of motion, then if we write down the equations of motion and we restrict ourselves to being at subhorizon scales, that means we're making certain approximations, then the time derivatives drop out because the scales that are subhorizon dominate heavily over the time derivatives. And so you're asking if instabilities come in and break this.
Yeah, I think what you're saying, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that you can make an inconsistent approximation.
Yeah, that's basically what I'm saying. So the
smart equation is obviously inconsistent with the theory.
Yeah. So with massive gravity, I think that is the issue that comes in, that you have instabilities and you want to watch out a bit. I think Kurt probably knows a lot more about this than me.
I was specifically asking, and you can ask me later if you like, if I were to suggest that some of the things you're listening to is valid, I was wondering.
Yeah, so I'm not. Yeah, I think we should talk about it later because I'm not 100% sure if I'm answering the question you're asking, but sorry.
So why is DGP in the valid list and massive gravity in the non-valid list? Because I would have thought the DGP is a theory with a massive graviton.
Oh, okay. I think that, so I believe that the issue with massive gravity comes in when you have bimetric massive gravity. I'm not 100% sure, to be honest. This isn't really my area of expertise. I've read papers that say that these ones work and these ones don't, and I can't really go into a lot more detail than that, unfortunately.
I used to worry about DGP too. That should be a
common. You've laid a red cape in front of me.
Yeah. Maybe I should have left this slide out. Okay, we can talk about this later more if you want. Okay, so provided that we agree that we're using a theory of gravity for which this is okay, then what happens is that we have an ability to parameterize modifications from GR using the Poisson equation and the slip relation, which are shown for GR here. So what happens is we just get functions of time and scale coming into these equations. So we also want to account for the fact that we could have a deviation from a lambda CDM expansion history. So we account for that by adding a function of time to the equation of state of the effective dark energy component. And it's going to be a bit more useful for us if we switch to this sigma mu bar sort of parameterization instead of delta mu and delta gamma. The reason we're doing that is because, again, to be a bit more observationally motivated, these are the parameters that are typically used by people doing galaxy lensing analysis. So we've just essentially taken a linear combination of the parameters we were already using. And there we have our three parameterizing functions that tell us about our deviations from GR and lambda CDM.
So,
yeah.
Push on a question. You've already taken the short horizon limit.
Yes.
But this function's, you know, it's a free function of A and K. I could also imagine deviations from standard Poisson equation coming from dark matter on smaller scales.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're thinking about accelerated expansion, you're normally thinking about stuff on large scales, which you're already neglecting. So what's the motivation for the, I mean, you're going to take some prior range on what K this is allowed to deviate from 1.
Right. Okay, so...
is there any fundamental reason to apply this only to theories that are related to accelerated expansion that apply on somewhere between, you know, the horizon scale and the nonlinear scale, and not outside of those?
Are you worried about the form that we're going to allow delta mu and delta gamma to take in K, or...?
Does this parameterization have to have something to do with accelerated expansion? Or could you apply
right.
it on more scales and say it doesn't have to have anything to do with the... Because the moment this doesn't have anything to do with the back, apart from W, mu and gamma don't have to have
no, it's only clustering, yeah.
You could do the theory of matter and apply it to some higher K or something like that.
Right.
Does it have to do with gravity at all?
Okay, so you're asking, like, if I had a theory of gravity that accounts for, if I had a theory of modified gravity, like, something that is designed to reproduce the dark matter properties instead of dark energy.
No, I'm saying if I modified the theory of matter.
Oh.
And then you could change on a different range of K.
So you want, like, say your delta M is, like, the thing that's being modified here to give you this deviation instead of changing like your G or something in the Poisson equation.
Yeah. Sure.
I mean,
it's just that like there's a particular range of K's that you're going to look at, and is there any particular reason to pick those?
Okay.
Does it have to be tied into accelerated expansion? Is really my question.
I think I'd answer that the cosmologist, you look at the particle range of K. If you have a different specialty, you look at the different range of K.
So when I get to...
Yeah, I mean, this is observational. You chose the range of K because it's observationally interesting.
Yeah, like, and also, so I guess, yeah, okay, so I'm not sure. So if you're looking at a cosmologically motivated, so i.e. like dark energy motivated theory of gravity, like this is fine, and also we have sort of not, I don't want to say constraints because it's not observational, but we have like reason to believe that, which we'll talk about in a little while, like of the form in K of delta mu and delta gamma, and there's a particular form, and it will sort of, as your K's get, I guess, yeah, no, never mind, that's not useful. I'm not sure, Dottie, I'm sorry.
But like delta mu could be degenerate in some range of scales with massive neutrinos.
True, yeah.
And then it's got nothing to do with gravity, it's the matter sector. So like, if
true.
You talk about degeneracy.
Okay, I see what you mean, yeah, okay.
It doesn't have to be modifying the G bit, it's just modifying something.
True,
It could be modifying the dark matter bit.
Yeah, it could, you're right. Yeah, I see what you mean now. I guess you're right. And basically, I'm mostly going to be talking about degeneracies between gravitational parameters, making strong assumptions about the lambda CDM parameters, and like going towards like degeneracies with things like massive neutrinos and other like sort of more like basic cosmological parameters is kind of still in a future work stage at this point. So yeah, I'm not looking at that, unfortunately. Okay, is it okay if I keep going? Okay. So if we, actually, I'm just going to go back for a second. So we have these three functions, and the whole linear response idea of this is that these three functions are going to be assumed to be much less than one in absolute value. And so this gives us freedom to be able to calculate a new expression for the power spectrum of the convergence under weak lensing. And so this is sort of a schematic for what it looks like. I'll show you the real expression in a second. But basically, what I want you to take away from this slide is that we have an integral over a time-like variable x, which is the log of the scale factor. And what we have is a separation of all of the GR parts of the integrand into this A kernel, and all of the non-general relativistic, so all of the deviations from GR and lambda CDM, are stuffed into this delta S. So this is going to allow us to separate off all of the effects of gravity, and in a minute we'll see that, in fact, the physical effects are separated themselves in delta S. So as a schematic version of that, this is what we have. And I'll talk about a little bit more about this delta-delta term in a second. So we have our delta S kappa depends on sigma, mu bar, and beta. As we just saw, those are our functions that we care about. This is what the actual expression looks like, perhaps more interestingly. So the first line is AGR, which we just looked at. So this is our kernel. And all of this is only dependent on GR. And the bracketed terms in the second two lines is the source term. So what we have is, because we have this linear response thing, we can Taylor expand things and not worry about higher terms. We get this additive separation with the different physical effects. So for example, 2 sigma, that is telling us about clustering properties changing. So the way that matter is falling towards other matter is different if 2 sigma is non-zero. Delta-delta, which I'll give you the exact form for in a moment, is telling us about how the actual evolution of, how the actual distribution of matter may be different in a non-general relativistic theory than in GR. The next term, 3 over 2 u, is an integral over beta, tells us about how the Hubble parameter is changing. And the final three terms here with the delta chi are a result of the fact that our co-moving distance and our expression for our co-moving distance is different in a non-general relativistic theory and not in a lambda CDM background than it is in GR. So basically, this is allowing us to write everything general relativistic, and then we have the source term separated off.
Question. Yeah. So everything after 1 plus
yeah.
is going to be 0 for GR or for lambda CDM?
Both.
For both.
Yeah, so yeah, you'd have to have GR and lambda CDM. So basically the first two terms, sigma and delta delta, are basically clustering properties. Delta delta also has expansion history in it. So I'll show you the exact expression in a moment. And the rest of it is lambda CDM. So if you just had beta equals 0, which we'll see in just a second, everything after delta delta is 0, even if you had differences in your clustering properties.
So why would that 3 half u of x, why the third term matches or the fourth term?
That's a result of a deviation from the time-evolving Hubble parameter in a non-lambda CDM. So it's the difference in the Hubble parameter in a non-lambda CDM expansion history.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you had WCDM,
yeah.
some of these terms would be non-zero.
So if you had exactly. So if you had just a W naught instead of minus 1, but your GR, GR is still GR, then delta delta would be everything would be non-zero except for sigma, but some parts of delta delta would be 0 because that's a composite expression that we'll see in a moment. Okay, so right. So as we just saw, here's our general relativistic kernel. Here's our source term. Okay, so we've got this expression, and now we want to do something with it. So we want to use it to understand where our degeneracies are coming from, and sort of what we can learn about them. So as sort of a first example, we're going to consider the case where we have scale independence in our mu bar and our sigma, and we have a lambda CDM expansion history. So we have 2 observables. Mostly, as I said, we're talking about weak lensing, but redshift-based distortions is sort of commonly suggested as a way of breaking degeneracy between gravitational parameters when combined with weak lensing. And so since we've decided to set beta to zero in this case, mimicking a theory of gravity which explicitly chooses to have a lambda CDM expanded history, we are only caring about constraining parameters of mu bar and sigma. So we know that redshift based distortions constrain only parameters of mu bar. So ideally, in this case, we would like that weak lensing would constrain only sigma, because that would give us, so imagining that mu bar and sigma each had were one parameter functions, then that would give us orthogonal constraints in the plane of those parameters. So let's look at our expression. So we have this source term, and this is what our delta-delta looks like in the case that we have a lambda CDM expansion history. So we see that delta S kappa, so our weak lensing term, does depend on sigma. And it also depends on this integral over time and these functions. So we have mu bar coming into this integral. And so the amount that our constraint from weak lensing is going to sort of deviate from this constraint only on sigma is going to depend on the time functional form of mu. X, remember, is a log of the scale factor. So if mu bar has a functional form in time that persists over long times, then this is a significant term, and the constraint from weak lensing will not be orthogonal to the constraint from redshift-based distortion. But if it's only if mu bar it has a functional form in time that only persists at late times, then this is probably not that important, and you're going to get almost orthogonal constraints. What the functional form of mu bar means, obviously, is sort of what theories of gravity.
Sorry, can you remind me what mu bar was?
Sorry, so I can just go back to the slide for a moment. So we're using this quasi-static approximation, and so we're just using linear combinations of delta mu and delta gamma. Is that okay? So mu bar is just at the bottom.
Gamma is the ratio of particle size, and then mu is the Newtonian.
Yeah, so essentially, we expect that sigma will essentially probe relativistic test particles in the potential, and mu bar will essentially probe non-relativistic with this correction that we're looking at right now. So the idea is that we have a small correction to the weak lensing constraint, and in the time dependence of mu bar is basically dependent on what theory of gravity you care about. And if you make sort of what is the standard assumption, which is that mu bar and sigma will both go like the dark energy density, so only persist at late times, then we will have like this integral will not matter very much. But it's possible that we would like to consider a theory of gravity where that's not the case. So we want to be sure that the weak lensing and redshift-based distortions as a combination is still a good combination for degeneracy breaking, even when that assumption doesn't hold. So let's see what we get. So what we have here is two plots of the degeneracy directions for redshift-based distortions and weak lensing. Redshift-based distortion degeneracy directions are shown in green, and weak lensing are shown in dotted red. So on the left-hand side, we have the standard assumption, which is that mu bar and sigma both go like the energy density of the effective dark energy component. And we see that we have the almost orthogonal degeneracy direction that we expected. There is a slight tilt, which is representing the fact that integral term does matter a little. On the right-hand side, we've chosen mu bar and sigma is equal to a constant. That is not supposed to mimic any particular theory of gravity. It's just supposed to be a choice where that integral term will be significant. And we don't really expect it to get much worse than that. So what we're saying here is this is sort of a heuristic upper bound on how bad we expect the degeneracy direction to be. And what we're seeing is that it doesn't tip all the way over, which is good. So we're obviously not going to get as good of a constraint if we imagine sort of putting our error bars on those lines. This constraint isn't going to be as good as that constraint, but we're still going to get a reasonable constraint. So what we're seeing here is that even in this sort of worst case scenario, we still have a reasonable constraint, and weak lensing and redshift-based distortions are still a reasonable combination for degeneracy breaking. Okay, so this is only degeneracy directions. obviously, if we want to talk about like future surveys and what we expect to get from them, we want to include forecast errors. So we're doing that using Fisher forecasting. I'll just give a quick, this is just a quick like Fisher forecasting 101 for someone, anyone who hasn't seen this before. So via this expression for the log of derivatives on the log of the likelihood, we have this thing called the Fisher matrix. And the Fisher matrix basically approximates an inverse covariance matrix in an approximation that's exact in the case where we have a multivariate Gaussian. So we're able to compute an inverse covariance matrix, and this gives us constraints on our parameters for a future survey. And so I'm going to show, just go through a couple quick examples of how our expression and, so how our expression helps us understand the forecast constraints that we get in the case of a dark energy task force 4 type survey, which is something like Euclid. Okay, so we'll first consider a case where we do take this dark energy, effective dark energy equation of, energy density for our motivated form for our mu and our sigma, and we'll consider like a CPL type deviation from the equation of state of our effective dark energy component. So this is like the W naught plus WA 1 minus A type equation that we're used to seeing. And so we look at possible constraints from a dark energy task force 4 type survey. So this first slide is with the case where we set WA equal to 0. What we have on the left is sort of the reconstructed posterior probability distributions for the case where we've marginalized over each of the other two parameters. So we have mu naught, sigma naught, w naught. For the furthest plot, we've marginalized over sigma naught and w naught. Middle plot, we've marginalized over mu naught and sigma naught. And here we have the one sigma contours for the case where we've marginalized over only w naught. And as we go from green to red to black, we're going from greater constraint from, less constraint from a baryonic acoustic oscillation measurement on the background to more constraint. And the interesting thing that we're seeing here is that mu naught is far more dependent, measurements of mu naught is far more dependent on having a tight measurement on W naught than sigma naught is. Basically, sigma naught doesn't care at all, almost doesn't care at all, about how tight your constraint on the background is, but mu naught cares a lot. And when we look at our expression, we can see why that is the case. So the reason that's happening is because in the way that we've seen before, mu naught is basically constrained by retrospace distortions. Sigma naught is basically constrained by lensing. And retrospace distortions are more directly sensitive to deviations in the background due to the form, obviously due to physics, but like understood by looking at the kernel that we have for retrospace distortions and noting that it goes all the way back to infinity. So like all clustering is taken into account. Whereas weak lensing, that effect is there via the delta-delta term, but our actual general relativistic kernel cuts off at the first redshift of the source galaxy that we consider, which in this case is 2. So we are not as heavily directly influenced by the background, which is why we get this tighter constraint on sigma naught independent of the constraint on the background. And then just to show you what happens when you allow WA not to be 0, basically the same thing is happening. So what's kind of exciting here is that we expect that we should be able to have this W naught and WA form and assume that for our deviation from a dark energy, our deviation from a lambda CDM expansion history and still get reasonable constraints in this kind of a dark energy task force 4 type survey. Okay, and then the final thing.
So it seems that you're saying as you make the background constraint worse, your error on mu naught expands, but the error in sigma naught does not.
It doesn't get as bad as mu naught. So, especially in this one, you can see like from the plots over here. So mu naught cares a whole lot more. Sigma naught.
Did you explain why? Why do you think that is? That the error in mu naught.
Yeah.
Expands, but sigma naught doesn't.
Right. So mu naught. So okay. So this is this is the form that we're using. And as we just saw, basically in this form, mu is
it because I guess sigma and this higher shift. No, actually, no, that's not. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, it's okay. So basically, mu is constrained primarily by redshift space distortions. So this is these plots are for weak lensing, redshift space distortions, and BAO with a constraint on the background only. So mu naught is primarily constrained by redshift space distortions. Sigma naught is primarily constrained by weak lensing. Redshift space distortions are directly affected by the clustering. Like that is the primary effect. So as the expansion histories changed at very early times, that has a direct effect on the redshift space distortion measurement. Whereas for weak lensing, the clustering at early times does have an effect, but it's a secondary effect versus the fact that the light is only traveling from a redshift that, say, in this case, the earliest source redshift is 2. And that would be kind of typical of what we would expect for a weak lensing survey in the next 10 years. So that light is picking up effects from the clustering from early being changed at early times, but the effect is subdominant to the fact that that's only affecting the growth of structure that the light passes by. It's not affecting the integrated effect of the actual change in the clustering is only picked up at the low redshifts, if that makes sense. So because the form assumed for the deviation from a lambda CDM background is persists at all redshifts, the effect is greater on redshift-based distortions. And because the constraint from mu naught is primarily a redshift-based distortion constraint, it's sort of losing power in its constraint because it's also trying to constrain W naught, if that makes sense.
So you think the constraint on redshift space distortion is lower redshift than lensing?
Or redshift space distortion is higher redshift.
It's
integrated over all redshifts. That's what the difference is.
Whereas
weak lensing is only integrated with source.
Yeah.
No, but we don't really see. What is the redshift strength of the what sort of set rate are you imagining for redshift space distortion?
So for the observed redshift space distortion, where we're observing it, this is for a redshift range between 0.5 and 0.7 and 2. But it's more the accumulated effect of the clustering has an effect from higher redshift more so than for weak lensing. Yeah. Okay.
So really, it's a really striking effect.
So this is a bit of a toy example in the sense that you would expect a washing out of this effect to a certain extent when you start considering depending on how much you trust the linearity of galaxy bias and stuff like that, because this is dependent on you being able to make an F sigma 8 type measurement where your galaxy bias cancels because it's a constant, a constant in the sense that it's not scale dependent, which is not necessarily going to be true all the time. So you have to be a bit careful about that. What I'm saying is not that this is the plot that we're going to get from Euclid. What I'm saying is more that, it's more that we can sort of try to understand where these differences are coming from.
It suggests maybe there's some combination of if there were, say, some combination of redshift space distortion and Lensing observables that just directly measured pi over psi independent of the expansion history.
Yeah.
I can explain why this is coming out of pressure forecast. But I don't see on hand how it constructs something like that.
Pi over psi is, yeah.
I mean, there's still distances compared to the redshift.
So I'm actually going to talk in a minute about something that might be a little bit like that, sort of a a direct combination of registry-based distortion and lensing that tries to do that. I don't know if that will be sort of what you're thinking about. It's not phi over psi, but it is like sort of, it's sort of like phi plus psi over phi. So we'll see. Before I get to that, I'll just, actually for time, okay, I might actually skip this example and go directly to that. So I was gonna go through a case where we, just to give a quick overview of this before I go right by it, this is just a case where we consider scale dependence with, so we have no scale dependent mu bar and sigma, and now we're letting beta equal zero. So we remember that we had these two options for how we were gonna parameterize gravity. It's the same thing, just linear combinations. So as we were saying earlier, I was trying to answer Dottie's question and failing. This is what we would expect for like a scale dependence from just considerations of like your equations of motion being second order. You have to have your mu and gamma going like this. And so what we did was, I'm just gonna go through this super quickly, but when we take a linear response approach and you, you restrict to being near GR and Lambda CDM, you can obviously write these expressions like this. It's only a Taylor expansion. And just converting to the other parameters, it just looks like that. And simply what we did was under a particular assumption for the time dependence, which is again motivated by like a dark energy type modified gravity theory.
I think that does kind of answer my question, because you chose the k dependence there, all coming from the derivatives. That's why you said it's k squared, because it's coming from the derivatives. That's why it's kind of gravity.
Yeah.
Because you're picking the order as being where it's the order.
Right.
If it was something from the matter, like, you know, the transfer function for the neutrino is like, you know, not k squared.
It's, right. You could still like
off as a kid minus three or something like that.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
it's not, transfer functions don't look like k squared, but stuff covered in the
right
registers.
But you could still like, I don't think that necessarily totally answers your question about like whether you could use those expressions for neutrinos. Cause like, this is just saying like, I want my stuff to represent gravity. I want my equation to be second order. Given that, this is what it has to look like. Whereas if you're like,
cause
if you want it to be massive neutrinos, then you're not gonna get this. But that doesn't mean you're wrong. It just means you're doing something different. I think for time I'm just gonna go through. So basically what we were doing here with the scale dependence, I'll just summarize, is that we just looked at a few, using like a Fisher matrix where we have these five functions and their parameters, we just looked at a few like well-constrained and poorly constrained directions. So something that we found was that if you just take a direct sum of the like scale dependent parameters, so you see like P2, P3, and P5 multiply k squared. So when I say scale dependent parameters, that's what I mean. For example, if you have a direct sum of those like 1 + 1 + 1, you get no constraint in that direction at all from weak lensing and registry-based distortion, which is actually like really clear why that happens when you look at this type of an expression. Because you can see how if you have the same time dependence for all of those functions, and you just have like 1 + 1 + 1 for their parameters, like entirely from mu bar, the k dependence will vanish, and the sigma dependence will vanish. Or sorry, the k dependence from sigma will vanish as well. So that's something that you can see by looking at those expressions. It's kind of interesting. Of course, that doesn't mean that direction means anything. It just means that like that's a direction that's really poorly constrained, and if we did care about that, well, too bad, we can't measure it. Moving on from that, that's kind of basically everything I wanted to say about the linear response approach. And now to sort of touch on, in the last little while, what Kendrick was mentioning about having a direct ratio of registry-based distortion and weak lensing measurements that we might be able to combine in a way to break degeneracies more effectively. So this is basically what the idea behind E sub G is. E sub G is a statistic proposed in 2007 by Zhang et al, which the idea was that if you combine a measurement of the cross spectrum of the weak lensing convergence and the galaxy position. So this is a galaxy-galaxy lensing type measurement that you would make. And you take a ratio with the power spectrum of the velocities cross the galaxy position, the velocities of galaxies cross their positions, which you would hypothetically be able to make from a redshift-based distortion or type of, so a redshift-based power spectrum of galaxies. You could possibly extract that. If you do that, the premise of this proposition was that you would be able to make a measurement of a gravitational statistic where the galaxy bias would cancel, but you're still using galaxies. So you have this like nice large-scale structure probe, which if you use the same set of galaxies for your lenses in the top and for your redshift-based galaxy spectrum in the bottom, then everything about galaxy bias that you worry about, so like color, like other galaxy properties that you might want to like avoid if you're a cosmologist and you don't want to deal with that stuff, all of that stuff will go away. So that would be great. No, only like cosmic shear, kappa kappa, yeah. So right.
So this gets rid of the bias, but not the dependence on the background expansion in space. So that's
no.
Different.
Yeah, it's different, and this was like actually, yeah, this doesn't even attempt to deal with that. And then so if you take like the expectation value of this, you get something that looks like a Poisson equation. So you basically you can see how like because you have a lensing thing in the top and you have something that depends on velocity in the bottom, you can probe sort of a combination of the potentials over the basically F delta here is probing a single one of the potentials, and you can hopefully get it some gravitational effects. So that's like a great idea. Unfortunately, it wasn't particularly observationally viable. So when the first measurement of this was made in 2010, which until like 3 weeks ago was the only measurement, the definition was sort of redefined. So instead of what we had before, we now have a galaxy lensing cross correlation function. So now it's in real space. So a similar measurement, but in real space, and small scales are going to be removed to avoid nonlinear scales that we don't understand. We have a projected galaxy-galaxy correlation function, again, with small scales removed. And we have, from redshift-based distortion measurements, beta, which is like your F over B. So this is obviously measured on linear scales, assuming that the galaxy bias is constant. So this should actually come out to be like almost the same thing as the original statistic, which is why, of course, it's why it was defined in this way. But it only precisely matches it under, for example, the assumption that the galaxy bias is constant and we're on linear scales, and a few other assumptions that I'll talk about in just a minute. So, but when you do make those assumptions, you get something that looks like the original statistic. So I'll just show quickly, this is the Reyes 2010 measurement, which was the paper that made this new definition, and until quite recently, like the state-of-the-art measurement. And so what we have here is on the right-hand side, we see that we have GR, F of R, and Tevez, and these are meant to be like the center of these boxes are like the theory values for E sub G. And these were sort of gotten from the original 2007 paper in which this statistic was proposed. These are the only theory curves that have been available for E sub G. So we have this measurement which basically is showing consistency with GR, in fact also consistency with F of R. Tevez is not looking so good. But we are not able to like compared to a theory curve that we actually trust to be the same as the observational definition unless we have these strong assumptions. And I'll just show as well, this is the new measurement from RCS Lens, which just came out sort of 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago. And again, we're seeing that we have a consistency with GR, but the theory curve is, again, taken from the original 2007 paper. So it would be nice to have a theoretical expression for E sub G, which is constructed using the actual observational definition that is, or rather, yeah, the observational definition that is, in fact, used to make the observation, which is sort of what I've been doing with my supervisor over the past little while. And so what we have been able to construct is this expression. So we have an expression for epsilon GM and epsilon GG in terms of theoretically calculable quantities, which is kind of exciting. This is not something that has existed before. And so the first thing we wanted to do with that was to, so these are the things that sort of come into this that were not initially present in the theoretical definition from the 2007 paper. So we have a source redshift distribution for our lensed galaxies. We have the projection length over which the epsilon GG projected correlation function is calculated. We have, the small scales are excluded in an attempt to exclude information from, for example, within the virial radius or even nonlinear scales bigger than that we don't understand well, and that's parameterized by this parameter R naught. And we have the potential for a scale-dependent galaxy bias. So we have this expression, it depends on all these things. And so the first thing we wanted to do is make sure that in the case where you actually take the limit of the assumptions like scale-independent galaxy bias, like a rather large value of R naught, so that you're making sure you're cutting out all nonlinear effects, like a long projection length, and like varying the source redshift distribution to make sure that doesn't have an effect, that you actually get the value that was proposed in the 2007 paper and which people have been comparing to. And fortunately, you do. So that's good. That was a nice first thing to check. We've also just been, as I said, we varied the source redshift distribution. That doesn't make a difference. That's good. And now we have these three other things. So we want to see what happens and see what happens to our theory curves when we vary these. So first I'll just show, these are preliminary plots, so just bear that in mind, but I'll just show you what happens when we consider a scale-dependent galaxy bias. So what we have here is E sub G over what I'm just calling E sub G fiducial, which is essentially the case where we have a constant bias. So that's in blue is the case where we have a constant bias. And in orange, we have the case where we have a power law type bias. And this is with parameters motivated by simulations from this paper. And what we're seeing is that the value of E sub G does change radically at small scales. I mean, that's not unexpected. That's kind of the point of having this R naught parameter. It's kind of interesting to see that this change does seem to persist to relatively large R. No, this is actually R. I'll show you a plot with changing R naught in a second. So what we're seeing is, we probably don't need to worry about this at this point. So even the measurement that I showed you from 2 weeks ago, the error bars are at a 20% level. So this is not something that is necessarily critical to current measurements, but it may be important for future measurements. And we're currently sort of working on adding the error bars to this for a future survey to see just how crucial this might be.
Well, this does get bigger than 20% if you go to smaller than R. So I guess the question is how small than R.
Yeah. Of course, you can deal with this observationally by doing simulations and subtracting a scale-dependent bias from your data if you need to. But it might be, it might be more intuitive to be able to include it in your theory curve. It's kind of what you feel is.
Well, I think the whole point is, get rid of bias. So you have to get rid of it one way or another.
It's one way or another because you can deal with it observationally, obviously, by subtracting it using simulation.
Just ask a bonus question. So this EG is defined. It looks like it's defined with numerator and denominator in the case.
Do you want me to go back to the definition?
It's just the only reason it's not canceling is because would it be correct to say that it would cancel if you computed everything in the case space at one k, but that is this is that right. You're using real space formalism where you're integrating over K, the K weighted instead of given R.
So that's part of the effect. So if you took the original definition and just Fourier transformed it, I think that would be the issue that you'd be worrying about. But I think it still wouldn't work for like the observational definition, because what you have is you're trying to cancel your biases by having like, so you have epsilon GG, that's two factors of bias, and that's like, that's real bias, that's like whatever your bias looks like in your galaxies, it's in there, no matter if it's scale dependent or if it's constant or whatever. Epsilon GM, that's one factor, and again, it's whatever the real bias is. Beta, that's one factor in the top, but it's assumed to be constant. So like that measurement, you make that measurement of beta, it's a constant, and you don't, like, you can't include scale dependent bias in that if that's really the definition you're using.
Oh, I see. I think,
yeah.
I made it a beta of K, did everything. But I made it everything.
Yeah, I think you could if you had a way of making that measurement. I'm not sure that that is possible, because I think you might be able to. That's an interesting idea. But my understanding was, like, from redshift based distortion data, that's not super easy. But I'm not sure. It's a good question.
I think the only way to do it would be to measure is the ratio of the power spectrum quad pole to non-pole.
Like the one, like the original definition.
But then that's just going back to
Yeah, I think the issue with the original definition that caused them to redefine it was that the redshift-based distortion data, like, what they wanted was to extract, yeah, the PVG term, which would be great, but it's just not, like, my understanding is that, like, the signal-to-noise is not there in your redshift-based distortion data at this stage. So, like, maybe in 20 years, that's something that we can do easily, but I don't know. Yeah, I have to talk to someone who's a bit more of an expert than me on future redshift-based distortion surveys. But okay, so just about done. So you have this galaxy bias. Okay, and then as Dottie was asking, what happens when you change R naught? So this is a case where we have assumed a power law bias, and we've changed R naught. So we could also do this for a constant bias. When we include this power law bias, we would hope that it's some R naught, our curve would converge to not caring about the R naught that we choose. So we would like to go to like a sufficiently high R naught that we have two curves overlapping basically. And going up to R naught is equal to 3, where the sort of fiducial value that people tend to choose is R naught 1.5, doesn't seem to quite get there for this bias model. To be clear, the R naught 1.5 is motivated by a particular bias model that's not this bias model, which is kind of why it's interesting to check what happens in a different bias model. Basically what we're seeing is that we need to go higher. The reason I don't have the higher curves in here is because we're still computing them for like a higher R naught. So hopefully, like, you know, somewhere between 3 and 5 or something, we're getting convergence. But it's kind of interesting to see. Ideally, it would be, yeah, so in a case where we have constant bias, or in a case where we have that, the type of bias model that sort of motivates the choice of R naught equals 1.5, we would expect that by 1.5, we'd be like fine, because we'd only be worrying in the constant case about the virial radius of the galaxies and small scale nonlinear effects. Yeah.
Is this based on real data, or is this just?
This is theory. This is all theory. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry about that.
So what is that?
That's because it's like numerical jitter and I'm trying to work it out. Sorry, yeah, preliminary plots. So the final parameter is the projection length, which I don't even have preliminary plots for, so sorry about that. But that's kind of current work, and hopefully be able to put a paper out soon and those plots will be in it. One more thing, if I have maybe just 1 minute. Those plots were all in GR. So even within GR, you have these like non-gravitational parameters that you want to worry about. What does ESA-G look like in non-GR cases? So again, using this quasi-static parameterization, this is just to show you kind of the level at which we're expecting a difference. So a 20% difference in mu naught and gamma naught is the red curve versus the black curve is GR. So that's like I don't know, it's a fair difference. It's not that much of a difference. You wouldn't detect that with
so
current surveys.
These are like 1% changes to EG, and you're saying the current surveys are giving errors of
20%. So this is obviously not going to be detected, yeah, at the current surveys, but hopefully with sort of next generation we get there. One thing we obviously want to worry about is the fact that E sub G is one number, and so you are not going to be able to detect a difference between mu naught and gamma naught with this one number. So for example, here we have two different sets of parameters. Obviously mu naught, gamma naught, like you can translate that to like your two parameters of your favorite gravity theory. Like any two different physical effects, you're not going to detect it with EG. That's a strong statement and perhaps should have some caveats. But this case, we have like a 30 and a 40% deviation versus like a 5 and 10% deviation. They're almost the same.
What are those deviations compared to like what we know?
Right, right now?
Like, yeah, well, how big can we not gamma be from?
From C of H T lens or?
Yeah.
Yeah, so from C of H T lens, it's like a 50% constraint. So those are all within our current data from lensing.
And that like then has been changed like about as big almost as it could be.
Yeah, yeah, correct. Yeah. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say. Basically, we looked at some analytic approaches to understand degeneracies, and we want to get into exploring degeneracies, like has been mentioned, with things like mass of neutrinos and other basic cosmological parameters, which is going to probably involve going towards an MCMC type sort of sampling parameter space, moving away from an analytic approach, but that's what we want to sort of get into next. And thank you very much for listening, and thank you for the opportunity to speak. And if there's any more questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Or perhaps.
Question for David. So what is the, being that you're maybe not an expert in what future surveys will be, but
yeah.
that few percent difference from the GR value for PG, like how futuristic is that? Is that generation or next generation?
Sorry, so you mean like when are we going to be able to distinguish between that, or when are we able to distinguish between that?
Either. I mean, just,
okay.
When would I see a difference in GR?
When are we going to see a difference using this statistic? So this is something that we're kind of calculating right now. It's actually like really annoyingly non-trivial to calculate the like expression for what we expect the variance to be in real space. Basically, I think I don't want to speculate too much because we're still computing it. We're expecting, so like for example, yeah, I don't think I can really say too strongly using E sub G. I would expect just off the top of my head, like I would expect like 5% or something from something like Euclid, but that is like, yeah, not from a calculation, that is just like me guessing. So, but for something like Euclid or LSST for like from like a likelihood combination analysis type thing, which is like what we were talking about in the first part, we're looking at like 5% constraints on mu naught and gamma naught. So if we're not hitting that for E sub G in that survey, in like that type of survey as well, there's kind of no point of E sub G, I guess, unless you really think it's really helping with your bias. Yeah. Cool. Okay.
Here's a Bill Post question. What do you think is the most interesting alternative model to GR to constraint? I guess when I think about this, I want to know what physics should we be paying attention to? And maybe we can start optimal statistics. We want to measure EG or something else.
I guess like my whole like idea about this is that there are so many, but there's quite a few like theories of gravity that are still viable. And I guess we want to be as agnostic as possible. There's like kind of some different tests that you would want to do for something like chameleon gravity, or chameleon gravity maybe is getting a little bit ruled out, but not quite, but something like with an exclusion radius is going to be a different type of test, I guess, from something like F of R. I don't know. I don't want to like Yeah, I feel I don't want to like speculate on like what it would be, because I don't want to say like we should look at this theory, because like everything I've been saying is like we should look at like everything. And when we go towards like, yeah, more like degeneracies with other cosmological parameters, I guess we want to move away from the quasi-static approximation as well. So like that would allow us to use something like an effective field theory parameterization of gravity to like sort of take into account even more theories. So I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that, unfortunately.
Part of the reason you don't have a good answer is that I don't really think there is on the market completely consistent.
I think there is a good answer to that. Seriously, is that is the theories that people in this room work on.
Yeah. Yeah, we're all the
shit. Everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, seriously, I don't think there's really any completely consistent one on the market. F of R, maybe the only one.
No, but I mean, general relativity is not completely consistent, but
that's true.
So that's not that's a very high bar, I guess. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think
doesn't make a prediction that's in gross conflict with what we know about interplanetary drifts. That's not far. I mean, well, but massive gravities don't predict anything in gross conflict.
So the thing that all of these theories is that right now aren't micro, almost all of them have a free parameter, and if you tune them, then you match GR. So obviously,
I think there's a very interesting sociological factor like thing going on here. So people are like, okay, which is best, modified gravity theory, and let's contrast it to inflation, right? Mm-hmm. So. This paper, I was like, oh, inflation is falsifiable in the building, like taking into account the whole model space in the priors and all of this. If you did the same thing to modified gravity, it would be exactly the same. Right? It's an unfalsifiable paradigm, but like, who gives a shit? Mm-hmm. But the sociological fact that I would want to point out there is like the same kind of people who are saying, like, oh, inflation is an unfalsifiable paradigm are often the same kind of people who are working on modified gravity, which is in itself exactly the same thing. And so I think that, like, you know, model-independent approaches like this, like, let's measure some parameters, just like inflation, what are we ever going to measure? We're going to measure AS, NS, they're the things we measure. We want to take, like, you know, model-independent parameterizations of what we do, and, like, who cares whether your paradigm is falsifiable or not? I think it's a bit relevant question. Sorry, that's biased.
No, thanks. That's good. No,
I'm sorry.
No, that's good.
Well, in the case of inflation, we do know that we should mainly be looking for two numbers, NS and R. And that there are higher order things to look for, but there, you know, it's less likely to see them.
And
I think it's
just
the same thing.
This is what tells us kind of about what we should be looking for in theories and in theories of modified gravity.
Yeah, I think it's the same kind of thing. Yeah.
Inflation, flow equation,
three functions.
Sorry, in gravity or in inflation.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I guess. Like, I mean, there are, like, this is obviously a very simple way to parameterize. And like I was saying, like, you can go further, and you can, like, there are further ways to parameterize that don't use the quasi-static approximation, which gives you, yeah, like 21 free functions or whatever it is. But it's not as bad as it maybe seems. And I don't know, like, you can say things like, for example, the thing with the scale dependence, like, what is our scale dependence going to look like? We don't know, but like, if we want our equations of motion to be second order, we kind of do know. So I don't know. Yeah, I kind of.
So I guess, yeah. I just want to make a comment on this. Actually, the last time we discovered modified gravity, it wasn't through parameterizing all possible deviations from this Newtonian gravity. Was back then.
Mm-hmm.
It was through asking some theoretical questions, and well, somebody coming with an answer to that.
What would the theoretical question?
Well, I guess at the time it was. I mean, I guess it was a special relativity and how. My point is that asking theoretical, at least last time it worked,
those theoretical questions don't lead to GR. You can't guess GR just from asking.
But it doesn't uniquely, but I think at least that kind of guided the way. I don't think that GR probably was, I'm not even sure whether that was the only answer, but I kind of, that was better than just randomly searching for all possible alternatives.
Well, historically, I mean, GR was arrived at by, you know, one guy saying, I have this idea of, you know, what beauty and consistency are supposed
that's
to
not,
be.
That's
and
not,
and then we'll work it out and
then
we'll work
it. Yeah. That's not true. He was trying to solve an observational question. He wasn't writing down theories that he was trying to explain the parakeeting in a vacuum.
No, he was a postage.
Yes, he was.
He was all about
beauty. Yeah, no, I've done lots of theories, all trying to explain parakeeting
and vacuum. I know, if you know any historical evidence for that, I'd love to hear it because I don't know of any, and all the stories I've ever heard are the exact opposite.
I do think there is a guiding principle in this, which is the cosmological constant.
Absolutely, I agree with that.
Which most things by that gravity say absolutely nothing about.
That's true.
But you're motivated, that's sort of what you have in the back of your mind while you're working at it.
Well, there's a long history of if you run into a paradox, that's a good place to push on.
That's my comment. Things work this way. This time around, but that's how they were last time, by asking a theoretical question. And the best idea by observations, but it was the interplay of both.
I think that's true, and I think there's space for both to kind of hit it from both sides. And I guess. It's a good point.
Maybe we should
Okay.